The recession is over. Technically, the economy is improving slowly. Is life headed back to normal? Barbara Garson has her doubts. She's already written about changes in the economy and the workplace in books such as All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work. In her new book, Down the Up Escalator, Garson profiles a cross-section of Americans all struggling to survive and get ahead, and writes about how the financial stability and job security that we once considered a near certainty may just not be there anymore. I'm Jim Meadows, and Barbara Garson is my guest today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guest today, Barbara Garson, was active in the Berkeley Free Speech Movement back in the 1960s, and out of that cauldron came her 1967 satirical play MacBird, which placed the Kennedy and Johnson administrations in the framework of Shakespeare's Macbeth. More plays followed, including her children's play The Dinosaur Door, which won an Obie Award for an off-Broadway production featuring a 7-year-old performer who we now know as Vin Diesel. But Barbara Garson is also the author of 4 nonfiction books since the late 1970s, chronicling changes in the American economy and workplace. She started with All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work. Last spring, her latest book came out, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live. It's now out in a trade paperback edition from Anchor Books. Barbara Garson, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
And Barbara, Down the Up Escalator, as far as I can see, it paints a picture of an American middle class having to make do with less, and how this is really a long-term proposition for them. It's something that we think about in terms of the recent recession, but you make the argument that conditions weighing down the middle class go back several years earlier than that. I was wondering what particular thoughts or questions inspired the book.
Well, it's not just several years, it's several decades. Actually, I was asked to write a quickie book, you know, the recession, here it is, you know, what are you going to do about your house, et cetera. Of course, I can't do anything quickie. And then someone that I knew since the 60s, since he was in the Army in Vietnam and I was working in a GI coffee house near Fort Lewis, and he died. And I realized this was a very handy man who'd worked who I'd met after the Vietnam War, working in an auto plant in Lordstown, and who was part of that generation of people who thought they were going to make work better and make it more meaningful and slow down the assembly line and enjoy the great productivity we had in America. Oh, this is, I guess your listeners don't believe there was a generation of auto workers that thought about humanizing work. And it was a strike at Lordstown. I met him again, and I met him over the years. And over the years, I realized when he died and his children invited me to the funeral that at that point the children said, come see the house, because they had to walk away from the house.
That's the person you talk about in the introduction to the book.
And it's when he died, after all these years of working, owning nothing, having a small debt, having been a skilled worker who never was really unemployed but kept ahead of the automating of his fellow workers, and I realized, wow, this is the cause of the recession, not the derivatives, although I wrote about that, not the specific bank frauds, because when a bank can't sell a good loan, it will sell a bad loan, but that over the course of his lifetime, he had not been paid enough to buy back what he produced, nor had all his fellow workers. And that, if that's the case, then his employers, and in one case he worked for General Motors, his employers got the idea, oh, I have an idea. Instead of paying him enough to buy what he produces, I'll lend them the money. And just as GM became the largest lender, General Motors Acceptance Corporation, and in fact had to be bailed out of huge mortgage loans, so people started, I mean, basically Americans were sustaining their life while their wages were stagnant by borrowing. And that borrowing, it's not like the borrower, it's not the borrower that creates the loan, although it does take two. His employer was saying, I'll lend you the money. Now, is that a really smart idea? If I don't have $10 this year, how am I going to have, and my wages aren't going up, how am I going to have $15 next year to pay you back with interest?
So you're saying it's really dumb on both parties' sides.
Well, yeah, but the bank is the one that's supposed to look out for it, and they did understand it. That's why they were getting those loans off their books as fast as they could. But it's basically, you know, it started by not paying people enough, even though productivity was so great. And this is going on. This happened before the recession. They didn't get the QuickBook they wanted. They got a history of the last 40 years, and it's going on afterwards.
Well, before I go on with the interview, I want to welcome everybody else into the conversation as we talk about these changes that Barbara writes about in Down the Up Escalator. I'd like to know if it's something that you've seen around your life or around the people that you know, or do you see a different pattern? Call with your questions and comments for Barbara Garson. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Maybe we can start with a group of people that you opened the book with, and as maybe an illustrator here, and that's the, you call them the Pink, or they called themselves, I guess.
Right.
The Pink Slip Club.
Right. They found through their church that they were all unemployed. And they lived in Manhattan, so they decided to form what they called a pink slip club in order, they all assumed they would only be unemployed very briefly, so they would enjoy the things in the city that were free together, you know, and keep up their spirits. They would, and they did. They went to free concerts in the afternoons, and, they, you know, they played Scrabble in the afternoon, and they all assumed they would be employed again very quickly. And it didn't happen, and it didn't happen, and it didn't happen. And I'm here to tell you, because it's just 4 years later now, that none of them were ever fully employed. And these are skilled people, but I want to mention someone who is sort of unemployed in that group. He did, the chapter is like Seinfeld. I mean, they're popping in and out of each other's houses, and I record all that and how it goes continually, less and less optimistic. But eventually, he kept telling me he was unemployed, but in fact, he was picking up little bits of work. He did the computer graphics, the text layout, for textbooks. And this company didn't lose business during the recession because they did that testing material and preparation for tests that all the school systems are using now. And alas, they fire teachers, but believe me, they pay millions, hundreds, tens of millions on these contracts. His company kept having business, but they laid off the people who did his job. And as I got to see, you know, he used up his extended unemployment, and he was taking little bits of contract work, and I said, hey, do you ever get a subcontractor who gives you work from your own old company? And he said to me, I don't think I will. I wouldn't do it, he said. I have a lot of pride, but I don't think I'll get it because they tell me that it's going into India now. But he was doing, so that work isn't being done in the country anymore. He was now doing work the very same kind that he used to do. He was now doing it without any benefits, with much lower pay, maybe a little lower by the hour, but he got it so rarely and he had no benefits. The companies didn't pay him for 45 days. And his whole life was different. He wasn't part of anything. And that company did not lose business during the recession. They did very, very well, but they took the opportunity to transform a semi-professional, a very skilled white-collar worker, into a temp, into somebody who's very, very insecure.
Well, you write about, you know, that sounds like it's an illustration.
And that's happening to everybody else. It's not just him. That was just part of the long process, and they just used the recession for that purpose.
I want to talk about what you write about in the book about some of the long-term things happening that led up to these sort of changes. And you sort of summarize it as businesses making changes depending on which theory you accepted. They either did it because they had to or because they could.
Well, at the beginning of the 70s, there was some slight decline in profit. I think economists in America are, you know, American companies are still debating it. And that's the point when everybody started moving jobs overseas. So whether that was the cause or not, as time got by, as you got into the era of Reagan and firing all the air traffic controllers and breaking unions, then they got empowered. They could. So that even companies that were making lots of money, like the one I just described, said this is an opportunity to cut wages. And it's like been a war that's been going on 40 years. I want to describe one other. Because I met in the course of writing about the recession, I met a lady who worked for a very fancy women's clothing company that had its flagship store on Madison Avenue. And she, for many years, had been their top commission saleswoman. And let me tell you, I mean, you get to meet these people. She really loved dressing people. Every time she looked at me, she would say, you know, one pair of black pants that really fit, and that could tie that outfit together. You could wear that thrift store jacket. And she'd tell me, she'd send me notes about sales.
This is Ina Bromberg, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And okay, she loves her job, and she's making a nice commission. And during the recession, it made sense to her at first. The business had slowed up, and they were told, you know, okay, you don't have your old hours. You just we'll tell you each week what hours you're working next week, and the hours were much lower. That made sense to her. Then she noticed that they were still hiring people. They were hiring people at $10 an hour, which in New York is not a lot, but with no commission. No commission and no benefits. Why would they keep hiring new people instead of maybe expanding the hours that hers had been cut down to 10 hours a week? But and eventually, just what she thought happened would happen. They called her into the office. They called everybody into the office together, and they told them that from now on, everybody would be like the new people. Their hours dependent on, you know, they'd be told each week what they'd work the next week. They would be higher. They would go up, they assured them. But they would have no benefits. They finally canceled the unemployment insurance of the few older people who were left. And as she said, everybody left but me because I basically use my husband's business benefits. I'm older. I just want to go out and see my regular customers. But she said, this is such a different place now. The people here, they can't support their family. If they're supporting their family on this, they are so harried, they're running to the next job right afterwards if they have a kid. She said, and I never wanted this to be a family, but it isn't even a team now. It changed, of course, economically. You know, of course, you think it's fun taking care of your family when you don't know how many hours you're going to do and you're just not making enough. But it also took away, I mean, these people are going to come and go. This is not going to be a team or a place that she, you know, where somebody else knew how she took her coffee. I mean, all those little things that make you part of the world and part of the business and part of something, it's like becoming a third world country. Now, this company just took advantage of the recession to do this because they called the women in. They were almost, yeah, they were all women. They called them in and they said, once they had changed the terms of work, they said, we're not going to contest it if you quit. We won't contest your unemployment insurance, even if you actually quit with the new terms. In other words, they were offering them their unemployment insurance as their breakaway pay, and that's it. And they just took the opportunity of the recession to have another kind of staff, and a whole swath of jobs become jobs that they would say, oh, well, college kids will do it, but in fact, college kids need to earn money, and older people will, in fact, wind up doing it. It's just changing how our life is financially and also whether we're part of anything.
Well, this is fascinating. This is Focus, and we're talking with author Barbara Garson. She's the author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live. Call with your questions and comments. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number, again, 1-800-222-WILL.
And the problem, the problem with people calling with their, I never can solve their problems. I can only say, oh, yeah, you and everyone else. I think the worst time in my book, when I was sitting with that woman who was losing her house the next day, she didn't know whether, she couldn't understand the court decision, she didn't know what day they were coming. And she sat with me and she thanked me. She thanked me for listening to her story. And that's the point at which my eyes teared up. And she said, what's the matter? And I said, you were thanking me, but nothing I write ever helps anybody. And she was a healthcare worker, she was a home health aide. And she said, oh, I know what you mean, because all my patients always die. And I mean, people will call and I can't help them.
That must be, I'm wondering, is this something you thought about? Four books now, and there's really been, I think, a pattern of what you've seen of changes in the American economy and working life. And those changes are still continuing. It's not like you're leading a movement or anything.
Well, I mean, there is fortunately some people fighting for improving wages right now, which is just a beginning step. I mean, higher wages is the only patriotic thing you can do, because if you don't get money into people's hands to spend, you've got the same debt economy, and the next debt bubble, I'm not going to predict whether it'll be credit cards or school debt or something that I haven't even imagined, but you have a debt bubble if people all over the world, by the way, aren't paid enough to buy what they produce. But it's really, all the livelong day, which has been in print continuously since the 1970s when I wrote it, that described people who honestly thought that they were going to make life better. And it describes people inside factories, which are mostly disappeared, who are playing games and using their wit and trying to slow down the assembly line or speed it up. It was really about what they do to keep from going crazy on routinized jobs. It was very fun and very, people's fantasies are really wild. And they all thought, or we all thought, that yes, we would make things better. And I every decade I've written a book, and things have been getting worse economically. I mean, the squeeze on people has been greater, and it reveals itself in frustration. Yeah. You said I'm a member of the free speech movement. True. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary, that Mario Savio thing. And we won completely, but we're going to reunite on the Berkeley campus where the students are so much worse off than we were.
Well, I was wondering, going back to that time, going back to the 1960s, going back to the time that you wrote your first play, that you wrote McBird.
Wasn't that fun? I wrote it for a teach-in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, because there were certainly a lot of issues to be concerned about then, but did you see these issues with work and the economy coming? Were those the concerns at the time, or did you have a different set of expectations as far as the availability of jobs?
Well, obviously, yes. Oh, we just dropped out of jobs and dropped back into jobs. That's how you finance the whole new left. You just, the women usually put on their high heels and went out and got a job. It was just as easy as that to get a rent covering job. while you were a student or when you dropped, when you were out of school. No, I never understood that there would be a time when you would think not how can I humanize the job, but just how can I get a job. We really missed on that. I give myself one little bit of credit that when we were around the Berkeley campus, one of the things I was doing was working with the farm workers down in Delano, California. It was very exciting to go down there when they were just beginning to organize. But again, we never thought they would be frozen out. We thought they would be, you know, that work would get better for them.
So which was, do you think, the long-term norm? The situation we're in now or the situation of the prosperity of the 50s and 60s?
You mean all given, well,
if you look at a longer picture of history,
it depends where you look. And here, I think I mentioned in Down the Up Escalator that America has been an exception. I mean, we think of ourselves as exceptional in so many ways. But America did have rising wages, not like the period that I grew up in. You're right. I thought that the years that I grew up in were normal, that a post-war era. And that wasn't quite normal. But still in America, compared to the rest of the world, it's true, we did move from the beginning to the end of every decade, starting in the 1820s, wages went up, hourly wages. And, you know, in real terms. And so I'm not certain. I think you're right that the period that I'm used to, one where you could just drop out and get another job, and, you know, the 60s, from the end of World War II to the 70s, that may have been a little unusual, but America really was different in that starting from the 1820s, with some terrible periods in between, we really did share some of our productivity. So when we stopped that in the 70s and 80s, we were really in a dangerous cycle. So I don't know. I understand your question, but I'm not sure I can say whether we're in the normal dangerous cycle or whether we're in a really different one.
Do you think that the context, the larger context of international markets, plays a role in what companies have been doing? Are they afraid of international competition in a way that they feel that they have to be more like what's going on, say, in Asia?
Well, again, that goes back to the very first question you asked. What happened at the beginning of the 70s? In fact, the competition at the beginning of the 70s was really Japan and Germany coming back in line after World War II. It seems like a long time, but that's the point at which they were our competitors and completely newly built, not old great industry, but brand new great industry. So it may be, and then we said, oh, I know, American businessmen said, I'll produce this stuff abroad and sell them to Americans who I won't pay. Did they have to go overseas? Are they forced into this competition? It's different in every industry, isn't it? Our lowest wage industry, restaurants, they're not forced into it. Are they? You can't, because you're hungry, go abroad to eat. I don't know. I just know that we will be doing a patriotic thing to fight back, and that when you meet employers who understand this, and they do, my goodness, if you read the Financial Times, you'll see they understand it. What they say to you about wages is, make me raise wages. Please make me raise wages. In other words, but do it for everybody. If you get laws passed, if you form unions, I raise your wage, and everybody else has to, and I'm still in the competition. That at least comes for the service business. And we are in a position to raise the standards in Asia, too, not only for ourselves, but for the Germans manufacturing in Asia and the Japanese manufacturing in Asia. I'm not worried that if we raise wages, we will lose business, because we is now international. I mean, we, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, I'm
it's the only direction to push.
I'm struck now by an article I saw in the New York Times from a week ago, and talking about the impact of what's happened with wages and with middle class wealth. And it was a piece by Nelson Schwartz writing that the eroding of middle class wealth was being seen in hard times for businesses dependent on middle class trade, like mid-level restaurant chains and department stores, so that Sears and JCPenney struggle, Red Lobster and Olive Garden struggle, upscale stores do well.
Oh, I'm living in Manhattan, can I tell you that?
And discount outlets, dollar stores do well. Schwartz writes, if there is any doubt, the speed at which companies are adapting to the new consumer landscape serves as very convincing evidence. Within top consulting firms and among Wall Street analysts, the shift is being described with a frankness more often associated with left-wing academics than business experts.
I know. I can't believe that I'm living in a country where the Congress wouldn't do the tried and true, well, at least tried and true since the 30s, things you do to sort of redistribute wages so you can start the game again. That's the tried and true, and people in the Financial Times will write about it, the experts will write about it, and I can't believe that our Congress won't do those things. And more importantly, more shockingly, that the European governments won't do that redistribution.
Well, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Barbara Garson about her argument that economic changes over the past 35 years or more have taken their toll on the American middle class. This is Focus on WYLL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guest today is author Barbara Garson. Her latest book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live. It's now out in a trade paperback edition from Anchor Books. We welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Talking, Barbara, earlier about changing expectations, and I thought you illustrated that in your book by writing about Chuck and Michael Kenny, a father and son, with really different expectations about work and their careers and what they expect to get out of them.
Oh, yes. This young man, we bought a car at the beginning of the recession on that Cash for Clunkers program. And then the car came with an FM. But the radio station, you know, and this young man kept calling to ask if we wanted to, or rather, the station.
You're talking about Sirius XM, yes, the satellite radio service.
Sirius people kept calling to see if you wanted to actually pay for that subscription, which, of course, we didn't. And one day I heard my husband say, yes, I'll do that. And he told me he had talked to a young man who was so clever. And he told him, I'll figure out, I'll make sure you won't go on paying above the low rate to begin with, et cetera. So and he told me, you ought to go talk to this guy because if he's unemployed now. That's why he's doing this. So he wasn't completely unemployed. And I talked to him, and I went out there and I talked to him and his father because he and all his friends were living on these little jobs that they would pick up, and they really didn't expect to do anything else. And his father was a religious man, very religious, and very right-wing. Well, I would sort of right wing, he just was in despair that his son wouldn't, you know, get a real job or didn't seem to want a real job. But it turned out that he, the father, had been managing a warehouse with several hundred, mostly temporary workers under his charge, who for a big company that I didn't know name because he still works there. and it isn't Walmart. And his wages hadn't gone up. He was working 10-hour days now, remember, because he's a manager, doesn't get paid extra. He took the job because it was steady and he would be able to coach Little League teams, which was his hobby. And now he can't do that because his weekends are taken up. They are trying to get him to leave because he's older. It pretty much told him that they would take away his pension if he didn't quit. But he said, the Lord told me the right things to do, and I'm blah, blah, blah. You know. And he was a really nice guy. But when I asked him what his son could do, what his son's friends could actually do, when it came to his son, his, you know, we both thought his son could do something, surely. But when it came to his friends, it was just they should tie on that hairnet and work at McDonald's until they learn to do the job well enough that they get to be managers, and then maybe my company will hire them. But the father said that the company wanted to get rid of him and hire young people like that at half his wages, he had said earlier. I mean, it was just hopeless. And the kid looked at the father's loyalty and said, I am not going to be like that. I am never going to give a company my life and them not pay me back. And I found myself, I approved of what the son said, but I found myself trying to explain that when your father made that deal, it was a real deal, and the rug has been pulled out from under him. These two, you know, I can't even begin to go on into it on the phone, because these father and son were so tangled up with each other, as fathers and sons always are, that it was like going back and forth between them. You know, they loved each other, and they really couldn't, tearing their hair out about what each other was doing, and without fully realizing that the times had really changed.
That's really interesting. I want to go over to...
And he was like a hippie in the 60s, this kid, and I want to say one thing.
You're saying the son was like a hippie?
Yes.
Okay.
No, because, you know, he wasn't going to... It was as if he... But the artwork and the stuff on the walls that he was doing was a lot better than the tie-dye we did in the 60s. I want to say one thing.
Yeah.
Because I want to raise this discussion. I raised it already when I told my publisher I'm not writing about a six-month recession. I'm writing about a 40-year downturn that led to it. And we now talk about middle class and inequality as if the problem is somebody gets $100,000 and somebody gets $30,000. That's a problem because it's hard to live on the $30,000. But I want to make that inequality remind people that it's the difference, the huge spread we have now, or rather we have huge income spreads, huge salary or wage spreads. But the real important difference is the part of the production that goes to investors. Because if you get your money as an investment return, then you turn around and put it in the bank. You put it it goes back into your brokerage account. It goes back into your bank account. And they are forced to do something with it. And what they do with it right now are the crazy things we're talking about, the loans that to people who can't pay back. And the selling back and forth of those loans to each other and the betting on whether those loans are really going to be paid, that becomes economic activity because you can't really lend to a company to expand because no one borrows money to expand no matter what the interest rate unless they think they're going to have new customers. I'm just trying to say that we keep talking about inequality, and it is important in our daily lives that some people make so much money and some people make so little. But I'll tell you something, it could be a permanent but mean system if one guy makes $1 million and buys a yacht and the rest of us work on his yacht. That could be permanent. It could be stable, although it's very, very mean. But the system we have where all the money goes to capitalist system, where so much of the value of what's produced goes to the investor, and it becomes investment money. It's not used to buy yachts. It's got to be invested somewhere. And you may not be used to thinking of big piles of money as a problem, but you know they are. It's The bank can't keep its money in the bank. And it's the crazy things the bank does with that money that bring the crisis from one country to another. Mortgage loans here. Uh-oh, that backfired. Oh, I know. I'll do buildings in Thailand. Oh, that backfired. I knew. You know, it's the necessity to do something with that money.
The money is just there daring you. You can't just leave it alone.
Right.
It's got to go do something if you're going to grow it.
A bank can't keep your money in the bank. It has to do something. If it can't make a good loan for a house, it'll make a bad loan for a house. If it can't make any more house loans, it will sell the loans to somebody else who thinks for at least a short period of time I can get 4% on it, and you're going to get the fee. And that's the inequality happens because so much of the money that comes from any business goes to the investors, is brokerage and bank account money. It's not just high salaries that mean that some people are making a lot of money and some people are making a little. As I said, the lot and the little, if the lot wasn't what goes to investors, the cap to capital, the lot and the little would be mean but permanent. We're in a lot and a little system, which is mean, makes you nervous when you don't have enough. Oh, does that make you nervous? And is also unstable.
Let's go ahead and take a caller. This is on line one, Ken from Champaign. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. You actually raised an issue. Actually, when you look at in terms of the stock market, what they do, these corporations, is they want to make the people that are investing happy. So it ends up that you know, a lot of the money goes for the dividends, but it also goes for these huge salaries. The other thing is that in academia, I heard a statistic, and you can sort of verify this or not, but it's gotten to the point that half the people are adjunct.
Oh, God.
And that, let's see, 20% are actually not tenured. And 30% are actually tenured or a tenure track. Now, this, I think, moves across. Of course, it's different in disciplines. That's what happens to averages. I would think in the sciences or computer science, there's a higher tenure or tenure track. But then when you get in liberal arts and sciences,
right,
the humanities, they're way low. So that's a whole system that, again, has been run like corporations. So I'll just go off and you can continue and good discussion. Thank you.
Ken, thank you very much.
Boy, is Ken correct. It was in the 70s that I wrote an article. Oh, I keep saying I'm right. Believe me, I didn't really see all this coming. But I was asked to teach playwriting or English literature or something. I was asked to teach playwriting as an adjunct, and that was a new idea. It wasn't even called an adjunct. It was that I would get an honorarium. And I wrote this article saying, well, I understand why they want to playwright like this, because they don't have many playwriting classes, but soon they'll be teaching English 101 like this. And it was like a joke. And, I mean, you know, I was saying that, and now everybody's doing it. And that always makes me wonder why academia wasn't the first place to notice how our life is changing. I mean, you've got all these people who understand literature, and they go back and forth across the country like migrant farm workers, teaching courses for $6,000. And
well, it's not just adjunct. You know, you mentioned English 101. When I was a student in the 1970s, my English 101 class, a composition class, was taught by a graduate student. And I understand that graduate students teach more and more of the academic load as years have gone by.
Wow. Gee. So who's going to get to be? But this is just an example of the change that we can see in the future. How many people are going to get to be, therefore, a much smaller percent is going to get to be what we thought of as, you know, a decent upper middle class job, a not fabulously rich, but a professor. He could send his children to college. A much smaller percentage of people who have that skill whatever that skill is in literature, as your caller said, the science guy will have maybe a larger percentage get to be the real job. But fewer and people have what we would call a tenure job. We used to call that job, a real job, just an ordinary job, a job where you get paid so much each year and you expect to get a little more as the years go by. I mean, you can see that the country is different. And, you know, one of the things that hurts a lot, obviously being poor hurts, but we're not talking about people starving. We're talking about people feeling that they're a personal failure. And the only success I ever felt from down the up escalator was when a parent called me up. Someone told me that she was so worried about her children's student debt, and they were so stupid, and what they did, and they did that, and they did that, and they don't understand this and that. And I interviewed them, and I just took all the payments they had to make as sensible young people who did what they were supposed to do. They bought a fix-up house. They bought a starter house at the time they were supposed to. They invested in their education, and not extravagantly. Then they had paid down half their loan. But when I looked over their debts for the month, it just didn't add up. And when they got the offer of a new job and they tried to sell their house and move, they couldn't sell it because of the housing bubble. And so then the question came up, would they be able to have a second baby? They had one and they wanted another one so badly. And I'm telling you that this is satisfying. No, this was just ordinary people, by the way. These weren't people suffering. These two people had kept their jobs. They were lovely people. And they had managed to keep their two teaching jobs in private schools. But I was pleased that the relatives that I didn't know called up to say, I understand now. I understand. It's not that they made all the wrong decisions, that they're stupid, that they buy things that I wouldn't buy. I understand that the dollars don't add up to pay their mortgage cost and their student loan and so on. And, you know, and I felt if I spread a little understanding, maybe I was doing something. Maybe the family would be closer and they could. I told them, by the way, if you could pay off, you could do anything. Pay off their student loans. Those are so oppressive. They are such unusually harsh loans. Until people began to be talking about inequality the way you have been doing on your show, people just thought they were personal failures. I did this way, and my kids, they eat in stupid restaurants, and they spend stupid money, and they don't know how to run their lives. And so if people now understand that something is being happened. I mean, it's a class war going on, and their children are losing. At least that's a little better. We're on the way to doing something about it.
This is Focus on WILL. Still time for your questions for Barbara Garson, author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live. Our phone number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. I have a caller here on line one, Eric from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes. Another factor piling up on the American worker is this 2% inflation rate, which the federal and state government is geared to because they are the biggest indebtors, and an inflation rate cancels a lot of their dollars because they pull in more money of cheaper dollars. Now, the American worker deserves and should have a inflation rate of zero because, therefore, the money you earn now would buy just as much 10 years from now, 20 years from now, as it does today. But you take a 2% inflation rate and gear that over 10, 20 years compounded, and your money, savings money, has depreciated immensely.
Okay, Eric, thank you very much. I'm wondering, I have to admit, looking back to my past years, I can think of years with much larger inflation rates.
Yes.
I don't know how that, I don't know how that relates to what's going on in the economy, however. Barbara, when you look back as far as the impact of inflation, think of the double-digit inflation we were seeing at points in the 1970s. What role do you see that playing in everything?
Well, Eric is right, of course, that if there were real inflation, your savings becomes worthless. But it was for reasons that seem to amaze economists, we're having very low inflation now. Could happen again, of course, but it doesn't seem to play any role in our current downturn, except that the fear of inflation, whether it's real or dishonest, makes people say, oh, the government better not spend any money.
For fear that it will spark inflation and all the problems that come along with it.
Right, but when you think about what the government should spend during a recession, you're really thinking that it merely should make up for, in quantity, this is what Keynesians say. I'm a socialist, actually. But Keynesians say it should make up in quantity for what was, for the spending that stopped during the recession. And then at that point, it should stop. But people use this phrase, inflation, and there is such a thing as real inflation, and when it happens, it hurts. But people use this fear of inflation to say that's a reason not to spend anything except, numbers. It's so hard for people to understand numbers. I thought I got millions on my last book, and then suddenly everybody was talking in billions. And sometimes this talk about inflation and 1% and 2%, and it's hard for people to conceive what it might actually mean in daily life. It's like someone came. Well, anyway.
Well, let's go ahead to another caller. We are getting a few, and on line two, Marlene from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you. Barbara was talking about how our lives are changing in general, and I was wondering what she would think about. Thinking it from the standpoint of expendability, it seems to me that not enough jobs are created even worldwide. We have more people needing jobs than we have jobs for. And because of our mechanistic world, we are thought of as chips in a computer, and everyone's expendable all the way up.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Because, you just feel like a dime a dozen when you're told that, you can come in these hours this week and the other hours next week and we'll call you if we need you, and that's your job, that's your part of, that's what you're linked to, yes. And a great effort is made to make the workers expendable, to organize the work in such a way that we're not dependent on this guy, And it's a terrible feeling, and you put your finger on it. Now, if we really do, as Jim suggests, have fewer jobs in the world that need to be done, then I guess we just have to work shorter hours because we've got the stuff is still being made. Productivity is going up so greatly. You can't just say, well, we don't need you to work, so you're expendable, so you're nothing, so you're nobody. I mean, I'm afraid that what I see now is very unusual. I see a sort of a ruling class that's looking at most of us as expendable or as useless.
Yes, this is what I think. There's a few people up there, making the computer, and we're all expendable.
and if in a capitalist society, if you're not an investor and you're not a worker, you don't have much place, and you feel bad, and no matter what you know about it. My husband lost his job. You can hear who I am. He certainly knew this stuff that I'm telling you. And it was Rupert Murdoch that fired him, so you don't have to. He fired the whole company at the New York Post. He fired everybody. So you don't have to. There's no reason for him to feel bad. I mean, to feel like he wasn't good enough. Well, even the individual investor felt terrible. He felt absolutely awful. He felt, oh, well, I should have taken a buyout. I should have gone into a different business. I should have. He felt like a nobody. And he knew everything that I know and you know about what's happening in the economy. There's no reason for him to take it personally. But he really felt like a person who can't. He felt completely expendable.
Barbara, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to try to wrap this up because I was struck by something that you brought up at the very end of your book, and you did express a little frustration at being able to, you know, come up with a solution to all these big problems, but you did come up with the word jubilee quickly. What did you mean?
A jubilee, you know, in the Bible, every 50 years, 49 years actually, you were supposed to cancel all debts and free all slaves, and today we are debt slaves more than anything else. And they saw that as a necessity. Many, not just in the Hebrew Bible, but in Assyria, many ancient conditions, they understood, like a kid who's playing Monopoly, that the game cannot keep going if all the money is on your side. And if you want to keep playing, if you want to stay up late and your parents want you to go to bed and you want to keep playing the game, you better slip a little money onto their side, or else the game is going to end. And a jubilee is a concept that came up over and over in history because it did happen, that because of debt, all the land was on one side. And, you know, if all the money is in one pocket, what do you think happens to the market economy? There's no market. Now, we're not at that point. It's not that extreme, but it's going to the extreme.
Well, that's where we're going to have to end it. I look forward to the book on that. Barbara Garson, thank you very much for being on Focus today, author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live, now in paperback. This is Focus on WILL.